program covers speeches on a host of subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Stay with us for the next hour.
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to this episode of Youth Station. My name is Muhammad and I am here with Sister...
This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
We previously started talking about the throwaway culture, the culture that is pushing many of the young people, mostly young people, towards this idea, this mindset that we can throw everything away once we don't need them, be it the people, be it the materials, be it whatever around us. And then we came to this idea that not everything can be removed, and not this idea, this whole mindset is going to be considered and blamed as something negative. So, as for today, let's talk about this this idea, this question, that how can I draw my limitations? I mean, okay, I'm young. I know that this throwaway culture that I see on the social media, that I see with all the people around me, has to be controlled. But my question is how to draw this limitation. Should I just write down and jot down the things that are all around me and the surrounding of myself? Or should I go for a wiser version and start reading books? How can I find my limitations? How can I teach myself and train my mind on this culture? How can I control it?
I think I can start this discussion with a verse from the Quran. Anchor this discussion with this verse, and it's a very shocking verse. It's in chapter 17, Surah Isra of the Quran, verse number 26 and 27. Now, this verse actually is talking about giving to the relatives, وَآتِ ذَا الْقَرْبَ حَقَّهُ, and give the relative his right, and also the poor and the traveler, and so on, وَابْنِ السَّبِيلِ. And then at the end, it says, وَلَا تُبَذِّرْ تَبْذِيرًا, and do not spend wastefully. Now, this is something extremely... Why should you talk about spending wastefully in a verse that talks about generosity, that talks about giving?
Yeah.
Even in your generosity, don't be wasteful. And then further, it doesn't stop here. It doesn't say don't be wasteful in your spending and that's it. The verse after that is even more shocking. إِنَّ الْمُبَذِّرِينَ كَانُوا إِخْوَانَ الشَّيَاطِينَ. Those who waste, indeed, the wasteful are the brothers of devils. Now, we're talking about generosity here. Those who are wasteful in their generosity, in their giving their rights to others, they're wasteful in that. Now, let alone us being wasteful in things that are not necessarily right for others. It's ours. We have the money. But we're still wasteful in that. We're still doing israf. We're doing tabdhir, according to this verse. This is something really that shocks us, that the Quran doesn't talk about money. It talks about a mindset. That, you know, framework of thinking. Like, when waste becomes a habit, it shapes who we are. When we are wasteful in
even if it's in generosity.
Exactly. Who we are the brothers of Shaitan. We're the brothers of the devil. So this mindset, I can remember, like, I hate people, and this is something that comes from the bottom of my heart. I hate people who see, for example, and this is something that I also have a phobia as well, who... write, for example, half a page, and then they have to throw away what they've written. They scrap the entire page and throw it away.
Oh.
Why don't you just tear that small... You know, when I was doing labs for my high school, I can clearly remember my notebook. All of my friends had finished their entire 100-page notebooks writing their labs, but I barely made the 50-page mark.
Because now, you were using it well.
That was not the only case. The thing is, I had more notes than my friends. Like, I could literally count the number of words in my page, and I can easily say they were double. First of all, I was writing very thin and small. Second of all, I would not even spare the borders of this page. This page on the Day of Judgment would be complaining against me as to why the hell did you use so much of me? Even the borders, you do not leave it for myself. That's how keen I was. Not to say that I'm really good at this.
This is how a Muslim has to be. We are recommended to avoid Islam.
Exactly. Not because we have abundance of something means that we should be wasteful.
Yeah.
When we had an abundance of it, we wasted so much, both in terms of agriculture, we had a lot of farmers wasting water in a very bad manner, both in terms of our personal lives. It's a very common thing that we waste because it's so industrialized. You know, I think sometimes we look back in the ages before us, in the eras before us. I think sometimes some of these technological advancements should be undoed, you know, Control Z.
Yeah.
We should go back.
In our relationships, in the way we are bonding with people, in every perspective we have to be aware. We have hadith in Islam that is mentioning mending relationships is better than excessive prayer and fasting.
Exactly.
See, mending relationships versus fasting and
now
praying.
Look at what's being compared here. Praying and fasting, which is some of the most important aspects
the
of one's religion.
The things that are the nearest to Allah
yes,
subhanahu wa
exactly.
ta'ala.
And you're comparing that to mending relationships.
Yeah.
Now, repair when repair is possible. That's extremely important. That's the message you're giving from Islam. Islam doesn't say stay in harm, stay in a toxic relationship, but it says that don't cut off people or don't cut off things or don't throw away things just because it's easier, just because you feel more comfortable, convenient. Mend wherever you can, and that is extremely important for us as Gen Zs. And I'm not saying that I'm perfect. I have wasted a lot myself. I can remember my teacher. I was traveling once with him, and he had his family in the vehicle as well.
Right.
And all of a sudden, one of his daughters, she sneezed, and she wanted a tissue paper from my teacher too, because we were in the front and they were at the back and so. So he took out a piece of the tissue paper, and you know how tissues are, right?
Yeah.
They have like two layers glued between them. So what he did, very delicately while driving, and don't do this, guys, this is not safe for driving. Very delicately, he separated the two layers and he tore half of it and said, don't do Israel. And this really got me like, look at how he is thinking. Me personally, when I come out of, for example, bathroom after washing my hands, take out the tissue papers and just, you know, it's so cheap, it's so abundant, like you can easily get one. We have like stocks of them at home. We buy a bundle of tissue papers and we just stock it. It's so cheap, like there's nothing harm in, you know, use. But then look at this guy. Although it's cheap, it's an abundance, my teacher, I really appreciate and I really pray for the things he has taught me. May Allah protect him wherever he is.
Inshallah.
He's so keen in how he is using that two layer of
and
tissue
paper. And it
doesn't
mean that he's not rich enough to buy anything else.
He was wealthy enough to own a home,
sometimes
to own a vehicle.
People feel shy that what if I try to avoid Israf and people think, oh my God, she
oh, the
or
class,
he doesn't have
the
enough
poshness,
money. Yeah,
the class.
Yeah, exactly. What if they think low of me or they feel like I'm hurting my own face in the world, in the society? So it is not like this as well. We have the opportunity. People might be even richer than us, but still they know that as Muslims they are recommended to keep this idea in mind. Well, let's go for a short break and then we're going to talk about the other perspectives to this throwaway culture.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
All right, so we're back with the Youth Station, and you're listening to the Youth Station. We're talking about the disposable culture. And I think it's not bad that we touch on the practical takeaways from the episodes that we had so far about the throwaway culture.
Yeah.
How in our day-to-day life are we supposed to draw the line between throwing something and keeping something? I think one of the most important things that we should do is think before doing something. Think before keeping or disposing. Ask yourself, am I setting a boundary here? Have I reached that limit? Or am I just, you know, dodging my growth? Am I just saying, it's more comfortable this way? Think. Are you buying this phone because you really need it? That your phone is broken? That your phone does not meet your needs? It's slow enough that it's not working anymore? Or is it because there is another model that is bigger, that is higher than this one?
I have to keep the luxury.
Exactly. Are you, God forbid, you're going towards divorce? Why are you divorcing? Are you divorcing this person because really you have met the conclusion that this relationship is not going to work out?
Or because you're just being impatient?
Yeah, you're just being impatient. Can you repair this relationship? Can you repair the hearts of the people? That's extremely important. I think this is the first step. Think. Keep thinking before. And how many times, just like the story I mentioned about the tissue papers, we just, without thinking, subconsciously, we just pick the tissue papers from that, you know, damn roll, and we just use it, and we just throw away the papers just because they're wet. My mother, now, remember, again, another story from the tissue papers. I can probably give you stories until the night. My mother, she would, whenever we use tissue papers, and they're not like dirty, just because we washed our hands, we want to dry them off. She would tell us to put it in a specific basket. We had a small basket in our kitchen counter. She would ask us to put it there. And then what she would do is, when it's there, it slowly kind of dries off, right? That tissue paper. She would reuse those tissue papers for what? For cleaning the countertops. Now imagine
so
this
thoughtful.
Culture. Tissue, they're very invaluable. You can easily buy them. What's the big thing about getting new tissue paper? But she would still reuse these papers although we were not in a poor family. You know, we had an abundance
of... Yeah, for sure.
At least I can tell you for tissue papers, we had abundance of that. Maybe we might not have many other privileges that others might have.
But this is the Islamic culture that is teaching us.
Exactly. So before doing many of these actions, because we're not thinking about it. When we are... you know, scrolling these tissue papers in our hands, not because we don't want to do, we want to do israf, it's because we're not thinking about them.
Right.
Think about it. Maybe take one step. When you're upgrading something, your vehicle, your home, think about it. Is this necessary? Is this going to really bring you growth in life? Or is it just because of for the sake of upgrading? The previous thing you're throwing away.
Yeah, just I think these questions will stop and avoid many of the israf that we can see today.
I can remember.
Once we start thinking and rethinking
exactly.
the way we're living.
I can remember I had a neighbor, right? He was upgrading his fridge. And his fridge, by the way, was a big fridge. And he was upgrading to a double-door fridge. And he was an elderly person, and we were just talking casually. And then I asked him, why are you upgrading? And he was like, you know what? I never really give a thought. I'm just upgrading. He didn't even think about upgrading. Exactly. So I think it's important thinking. And the second step is maybe... see if you can repair those things, whether it be a person or a thing. If it's an object, see if you can fix it, if you can reuse it, or even donate it. Maybe, it's a very common phrase, proverb, one man's treasure is another man's... I'm sorry, one man's trash is another man's treasure. You might not find value in what you have, but someone else might use it and make something valuable out of it.
Yeah,
see if you can donate it.
This is really helpful. I mean, I usually, because I have to go to different workplaces, I buy lots of clothes. Until I was younger, I had this problem with my parents, that they were always asking me, why do you keep lots of clothes? Why do you buy a lot? And then I started from sometime, like from a few years ago, to start donating the ones that I don't, like I had lots of clothes that I... wouldn't even wear them. I bought them, then I came home, I regretted, so I just put them away. So this donation, this idea, okay, if you're young, you want to buy lots of things, maybe you have a favorite thing, be it watch, I don't know, whatever thing, clothes, books even, the things that you love, and you go buy them a lot, though you have to be thinking about them. But if you have this habit, this tendency, you love to buy something, then keep thinking of donation.
Yeah.
What if another person can be benefited from it?
These are about objects... What about people? Talk, clarify, give them a chance. Your parent, your child does something wrong, give it a chance. Your spouse does something wrong, give it a chance, give him or her a chance. Maybe they might improve. Your parent, your parents, right? They do something wrong. Talk and clarify. Don't be aggressive and be like, I'm not going to come back to your home anymore.
Sometimes even just listen to them.
Sit on a dinner table and talk together about something, about life, man. It's much bigger than that.
Yeah.
God Almighty is not asking you to debate with your family about your religious affairs. Sit down and have a dinner with them. Have a lunch with them. At least you can keep this much of a relationship together. Online, don't argue just to win. This is a very important thing. You don't need to press your thoughts to someone until they accept it. If you think they're not accepting, if you think they're stubborn enough, fine, move on.
And there's no end to this kind of discussion.
Exactly. Be slow to delete human beings. Don't be, okay, this guy is like that, I'm just move on. I don't like it. No. Think about it. And I think these are, you know, maybe maturity is knowing what to let go of quickly and what deserves repair.
Exactly.
I think this
so
is maturity. And I believe I've had a lot of experience in this arena, both positive and negative. And well, experiences are just experiences, but they have given me lessons. And from disposable culture, and I'm one of the persons who was brought up in an disposable culture, and drawing these boundary lines is, I think, extremely important.
Well, with the wishes that this disposable mindset, this throwaway culture, can be controlled in the minds of all our listeners and in the minds of young people around the world. Let's end today's episode. We wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This week on the Moscow Report is one of the most important interviews I've done on this show. It's with the highly respected German journalist Hussein Dogru, who for the last couple of years has focused his work on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and of pro-Palestine protests in Europe. For his work, the European Union some time ago decided to sanction him. It's the first case of its kind, effectively taking away some of the most basic human rights of one of their own citizens due to their journalistic work. Interestingly, the apparatus they've used to take away his rights are the anti-Russia sanctions, even though there's no evidence that he has any links to Russia. He has had some support from important European luminaries like the MEP Claire Daly and the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, who see his case as fundamental to the future of human rights and free expression in Europe. And I do believe that it is important for journalists inside and outside the mainstream to stand up for his case and not let it to stand. Hussein, thank you so much for joining me. Now, first of all, what is your situation? You've been sanctioned by the European Union. Your bank account's been frozen. There's a travel ban. What is that like, first of all? How has it impinged on your rights and your ability to work and live?
So, thank you for having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk about my case. Being sanctioned as a European citizen within Europe is being in a open prison. You're stripped of all your rights. You're not allowed to work. You're not allowed to earn any income to support your family. You're not allowed to leave the country which you live in or even freely move as a European citizen within Europe. And I think the most hard or more extreme part of that is that my family is suffering from that, even though they have nothing to do with that, because the situation which I'm in, financial situation, but also legal situation, affects them as well. Right now, the situation with me is that nobody can assess, not even the German government, which is responsible for executing the sanctions on me, because I'm in Germany. Even they don't know what the legal status of me is, because sanctions are designed for foreign people living not in Europe, but I'm living in Europe, so it is a black hole right now for all of us, for my family, for me, and for my children.
To sum up your case, first of all, I mean, you're a German journalist, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the last couple of years, you've mainly been focused on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and covering protests in Germany against what is happening in Gaza. But you seem to have been sanctioned under anti-Russia sanctions. That seems very strange. Explain that.
To be able to understand that, I think we need to remember that Germany is not theoretically, but practically in war. State of mind is in a war situation and actively supporting a war in the Middle East, which is the genocide against Palestinians. So if a country is in a war, it is fighting a designated enemy outside of its country, but also inside of its country itself, which is its own population, which are the critical journalists, which are people like me, who are highlighting the crimes that our government here commits by violating international law, by supporting a genocide, supporting politicians who have international arrest warrants. And if you do so, then that's government, which is fighting effectively two front wars, is trying to suppress every single critical voice within its own borders to shut down any opposition. And to be able to do that, they labeled me as a Russian disinformation secret operative here in Germany, because their legal argumentation is, by highlighting the situation of Palestinians in Gaza who are suffering genocide, by interviewing Palestinian resistance factions like Hamas, like PFLP, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, I would contribute to the disinformation campaign of Russia.
I saw Claire Daly, the famous Irish MEP, talking about your case in Parliament, and as she said, it seems that pro-Palestinian activism in Europe is seen, as you say, as a Russian destabilization campaign. I mean, I think it's more likely the horrors of the slaughter of children that Europeans are seeing on their TV screens is why Europeans are taking to the streets. But they seem to suggest with your case that it's somehow Russian destabilization.
That goes far back about what happened within Europe since 2012-2015, when the whole conflict around in and outside of Ukraine happened. The European Union put some laws into place which enabled the German government to do all of these things. What they technically did is the European Union militarized information, militarized journalism, which are not aligned with their core narratives, which they openly say so. Maybe you heard of the DSA Act, Digital Service Act of the European Union, which started around 2018, which said disinformation is undermining the European project, questioning the democratic legitimacy. And by saying so, they started to target journalists here, which are not or questioning the politics of the European Union. And that turned into like a repression machine here in Europe, which is used especially since 2015-16 with the Russia label. Because as you know as well from your journalism, governments push illegal or authoritarian laws when there is a kind of fear within the society. And German society, or European society, is in a fear created by the European Union that Russia is going to attack us, or Hamas operatives are within European borders will do terrorist attacks. And these.
Because what is your views on Russia? I saw an article you wrote recently in which you referred to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which isn't the words that the Russian government or Russian media would use about what is happening in Ukraine. I know you're critical of the militarism that's happening in NATO, but you don't seem to have been campaigning very much, too much. You've been focused on other issues. You don't seem to be pushing Russian disinformation very much.
No, I mean, my view on Russia, which I expressed on several occasions, and also in my work as well, is I see Russia like I do see European countries, as well as two sides of imperialist blocs who are fighting for political capital interests right now in Ukraine. That was always my view. This is always what I critique.
And so you've been sanctioned for essentially under this Russian sanction regime, but have they given you any evidence that you are linked to Russia?
If you look at the sanctioned paper, which is public, it says, as you also mentioned at the beginning, sanctioned in context of the 17 Russia sanctions, then the explanation in that paper is by news coverage on primarily pro-Palestinian protests, the crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests here, covering a university occupation, which was for them apparently dangerous to cover that, and covering violent protests within the European Union. That was categorized as creating discord and destabilizing or threatening the unity of the European Union. But later, we got the evidence pack of the European Union, which was something completely else, which is critical opinions, my private opinions, but also as red media, my media outlet back then, about the German politics, about historical facts that we published. One example, and this is a historical fact, that former SS Nazis, SS commanders, SA commanders from Hitler fascism after the Second World War became commanders or generals within NATO and had very high ranking positions. The European Union categorized that as wrong and disinformation, or a critique of me that German journalists do not cover the repression against me was categorized as disinformation and used to sanction me as well. So it's two different layers, three different, accusing of being Russian, explaining with Palestine, but the evidence indicates that the German government was not happy about my reporting critique with their politics.
And so they've just tried to find, in intelligence speak, it's called throwing spaghetti at a wall. It seems that they're, see whatever sticks. It seems that they're just trying to push anything on you, but without any real evidence.
No, there is no real evidence. Technically, what they present as evidence is disinformation itself and historical revisionism. I think it was McNamara, the European MEP, who said, by fighting disinformation, we are becoming exactly what we are fighting against. And this is today happening. And I think Europe is not doing a mistake, is not a glitch in the matrix, or it is not a stupidity of certain political, I think it's a political line today that information needs to be controlled, critical voices need to be shut down, oppressed, even if it's journalists now today. Step by step, the liberal bourgeois democracy that we know needs to be dismantled by those who are upholding that, because today it is a barrier, it is an obstacle for them to push their militaristic agenda, their Rearm Europe project, and the entire shift to the right within Europe as well. And the only barrier for that is their liberal democracy. Now it needs to step by step demolished. This is what is happening in Europe.
So I want to ask you something very important, perhaps the most important question today. I've seen you actually sent me a document by a former European court judge. It's a recent document in which basically they make clear that the sanctions regime, particularly against you, because you're a German citizen, you're not Russian, is actually against European law. Now, I've read the document, it's all in legal speak, but it makes clear basically what anybody, even without a legal background, should intuitively be able to understand, that taking away a citizen's rights without any due process is quite clearly not only against European law, but against the founding basis of European civilization.
Yes, the report mentions several elements here. First is that the European Union, by sanctioning a European citizen, stripped off all of his rights, which he or she has within the European Union. which is freedom of movement, freedom of expression, and the right to technically survive, to be able to work. So these rights are stripped off. I'm not allowed to exist. Just to make it maybe more concrete, people think about sanctions, assets are frozen, as I would have like millions now in my account, then I would definitely not be here. And you're not allowed to travel, but it goes further technically. So what is happening with me specifically is that the right of existence is gone. The right as a European citizen is gone, as Janusz Varoufakis mentioned as well. You are non-person anymore. And I think that is the punishment itself. And if you go also further and read in this report, it also says, and for that you need to understand sanctions. Sanctions, like European Union describes it, about to bring a change in your behavior. And later they say it is not about non-illegal behavior. No, it is about non-illegal illegal behavior that we want to change. So you don't need to do anything wrong.
So if you think, if you suddenly gave up your work, if you announced on X or whatever, you know, your social platforms, that I am giving up my work, my journalistic work, do you think they'd just take the sanctions off? I think they would.
I don't think they would. Like, first of all, I would not do it because I did nothing wrong. I used my rights, which they are supposed to uphold, first of all. Second, I do not think they will reverse the sanctions, because the sanctions itself is illegal, because there is no disinformation, there is no wrong information, there is no support for the Russian government at its war in Ukraine, or whatsoever. I mean, the legal report highlights that as well, that the problem is not the person, the problem is the mechanism that the European Union created, that now a certain intent, a certain different opinion can be now punished without judicial control. That's also what they critique. It is an extrajudicial process.
Because if your case is allowed to stand, if what's happening to you is allowed to stand, essentially now the European Union can strip citizens of their rights for essentially putting across ideas that they don't like. In fact, on any subject, I mean, you've hardly even spoken about Ukraine. You've, like millions of European people, you've been angry, and through your journalism, advocating, if you like, for Palestinians or right to protest over Palestinians, and that's essentially why you've been sanctioned. So if your case is allowed to stand, it essentially means the European Union can strip anybody of their rights without any due process.
Exactly. Like, my case right now is a precedent case. If, as my lawyer said, you're holding the Pandora's box closed, and if you leave that now, that Pandora's box is opened, and it's doomsday in Europe. And we can feel that this fear is working in Germany, because there is the extreme self-censorship of journalists, of politicians and activists. They're not talking about it. Personally, they talk with me. It's so horrible with you what happened, but it's too hot for me. And this is the aim. The process itself is the aim.
And is that one of the reasons they went after you? Because I have the same experience as you. You know, obviously, last few years I've been known for my criticism over NATO policy over Ukraine, but I speak to mainstream journalists privately. They say very different things than they do publicly. But is that one of the reasons you think they've gone for you? Because if you silence one journalist, if you kill one journalist, you silence hundreds or thousands more. And is that, do you think what's happened to you has had a chilling effect on German journalism?
Yeah, what happened to me has a chilling, has an extreme dangerous effect, not on the journalists, but on the entire society and the political spectrum as well. It is something that is legalized by the European Union that gives all the possibilities to do that. So the governments itself can execute all of that by referring to the European Union. A, impunity, like the German government says, we did not do that, it's the European Union. And therefore, it becomes like legitimized for them, and they will they're extending these more repressions more and more. And that has a chilling effect. That has an effect of fear. That has an effect of what the liberal journalists described happening in Iran, happening in China, happening in Venezuela, these authoritarian regimes, but this is even far worse here. For example, I'm someone with a Kurdish background. I know all the political experiences and the repression in Turkey as well. In Turkey, they do it, the repression, without having a legal ground. Here in Europe, which is more dangerous, they have a legal ground now. They can refer to the rights, to the regulations of the European Union, and to emergency situations that they create themselves, and have a legal base for it. And this is, I think, the most dangerous, and it will attack in the future. Working class people who want to strike, journalists who want to write, musicians who want to perform arts, which the government does not like anymore.
And so there are increasingly other cases in Germany, the UK, Europe. I don't know whether you know that George Galloway, I'm sure you know who he is, very recently has gone into exile because he was detained as he got off a plane in London. There are other cases, my own case. do you feel, and these seem to be, it's difficult to know whether criticizing Israel or criticizing NATO policies on Ukraine is worse. But do you fear that with your journalistic colleagues and around Europe that there is increasing authoritarianism and a fear of extreme repercussions for speaking out?
Yes, we can feel that everywhere. If you, as a journalist, have no trade union backing you up, in contrary, being part of that repression, if you have mainstream journalists who are becoming now the mouthpiece of the governments here, by starting disinformation campaigns. I mean, we saw the best example, it was with me here in Germany. My sanctions are technically the result of the disinformation campaign of mainstream journalists here. Or we saw it when Jeremy Corbyn, a couple of years, was attacked by mainstream media for being anti-Semitic. We saw the whole atmosphere created by the 10% of media outlets that we are in a, there is an imminent threat for us, that Russia or someone else will attack us. That creates that authoritarianism. This is part of the authoritarianism because governments use media to enforce or control information. And that's the dangerous side. Like, the information that I gave is not wrong. Like, the best example, I interviewed Hamas representatives. That was categorized by the European Union and today by the German government as giving terrorist organizations a platform. The very same Hamas politician was interviewed by German mainstream media. That was okay. So that shows me it is not about if the information is right or wrong. It's about having the monopoly on information to influence the society. This is what they're afraid of, especially when you have journalists like you or journalists like in England that we saw from Electronic Intifada, SF Incident, I think it was, whose house was raided. And across the board, Richard Matthurst, for example, it's about if you have these little cases of journalists which you can't control, then you need to suppress them with all the means necessary. And it is, in the past, it was only the police, military, or the government itself, but they have now found a better tool, which is their own, which I call now state-funded independent journalists, who are the foot soldiers of their politics today.
Because it seems crazy, that this is one of my major points, that suppressing these journalists, and I know most of the people you've just mentioned, I'm sure you do as well, that there's some outstanding journalists out there who are all too often just correct in their work. Those who criticized Israel at the start of what happened in Gaza suddenly become more mainstream, the realization that what Israel is doing actually is not also not in Western interests. And indeed, for example, my work on Ukraine, I warned the West or NATO that they would fail in Ukraine, the counteroffensive would be a failure. And now you said that there should be peace. That is changing. It seems that closing down journalists have they perform a civil duty. And the idea that Germany shouldn't be blindly supporting Israel, the idea that Germany or the European Union should not be blindly supporting Ukraine, it's very easy to make that case, that it's in European interests not to do these things. And it's journalists like yourself who are stating that. So to silence them and shut them down, in my view, is simply not in German or European interests. It's damaging European interests
by silencing someone like you.
I agree. I think it is not about European interests anymore. It's about the interests of certain capitalist interests. It's about the interests of certain military-industrial complex. It's lobby organizations. If you look today, especially Germany praises up never again, never again, never again. If they mean never again, it means also for the most oppressed people right now in Germany, which are the Muslims, which are the migrants, which are people of color, which are Palestinians especially. I think this rhetoric, never again, upholding democracy, is used to push certain political interests. I don't believe that Germany, for example, is supporting Israel because of the historical guilt. That is non-existent today, because before October 7, there was a sharp rise of anti-Semitic attacks by the far right here, but we don't talk about that. I think Gaza is a good, or October 7, the prison break of October 7, was a good opportunity to push their interest, to regain interest again in the Middle East, which they lost. I mean, pre-October 7, the influence of the West in the Middle East was almost non-existent, except the US. Now they have the opportunity to go in, now they have to push, or they can push certain political and military interests as well. I mean, we know that the whole thing that happened in Syria, it was not about Assad or not Assad. We know that the attacks on Iran is not about to bring back democracy in Iran. It's about step by step opening up the way towards China as well, to the bigger threat, economical, political, cultural threat. I think these are little elements that they use today to go for a long strategic political militaristic plan, and that you can see being reflected in the European politics. Rearm Europe. Germany wants to spend $500 billion into military. Everyone needs to spend more for militarization. But those who talk about unemployment here, about housing, about economical crisis, they're being shut down. And these journalists, it's been you, it's been me, and it's been others as well. So we should not talk about the misery that this system here created, but we should look at the supposedly threats that come from Asia and Middle East. It's a distraction for me. Yes, we have problems around the world, obviously, but we need to start here. We need to start fixing things in these countries before we bomb other countries, like it is a European tradition to do so.
And so what do you plan to do now? I mean, I know you've had some quite important support from some European MEPs, Yanis Varoufakis, the famous former German economy minister. You have got some
economic
Greek, what did I say? German, I'm so sorry. Greek economist, economic minister. So you do have, you're a very respected journalist. You do have some support. But what do you plan to do now? I mean, is it difficult living now? You're carrying on your work as you can. What do you plan to do? Do you want to take this to court? How are you going forward in this?
Right now, we submitted our case to the European Court of Justice, which will now review our case and then decide at some point if there will be a hearing or not. Sometimes the European Court of Justice decides without a hearing yet it was wrong or right, etc., etc. But before submitting our case to the European Court of Justice, we asked, because that's the process, you need to ask the European Commission to rethink the sanctions 3 times, and they said no, it's legit. We did no mistakes, as the German Foreign Ministry spokesperson said, Germany does no mistakes. They literally responded to a journalist's question about me. Say no, we don't do mistakes. So we are waiting. That can take 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 4 years, we don't know. But there is a danger in that, as former European Court of Justice judge wrote in her report. Every 6 months, sanctions are reviewed. It sounds very good, but it's a danger because, again, there is a mechanism there. Every 6 months, they could sanction you again for another reason. While I'm fighting that, then another case opens up. So I could be in a limbo for years and years, maybe a decade. We don't know.
Especially as you're carrying on your work. So you don't know, you could say something or do something, they decide, well, you don't like that either.
exactly, like just me complaining about that, that my case is not covered in the media, was a reason to keep my sanctions. That was officially used as a reason, because that was disinformation for them. I'm still working, but I think all the newspapers who are in solidarity with me, they're kind of happy because they don't have to pay me, because they can't pay me right now, it's forbidden. It's, you can be charged up to 5 years, I think, for that, going to prison. But I need to work because it is important, especially during times when the oppression is the highest, to inform people about that so it does not happen again. And this is my understanding, never again is now, by standing up against it.
Because I think your case really is a deeply important case for the future of Europe. If it's allowed to carry on what's happening to you, then it will happen to other people. Do you fear for the future of freedom of speech in Europe?
I think the future is already now. I do fear. It is dangerous. It is very... It reminds a little bit of the dark times in Europe in the 30s. It reminds... And there are parallels to that. I don't say it's the same, obviously not, but parallels do happen. I think it was before Hitler took power, or short after that. Don't nail me on the year, like 36, 7, 38. There was a law brought up by the Nazis called Schriftleitergesetz, which meant that newspapers or the editors-in-chief needed to report benefit, like in how do you say that, in line with the governmental interests. Otherwise, they could be arrested, persecuted, or killed. Today, they don't kill you, literally, but the EU says. And that's the whole definition of sanctions as well, which is quite creepy. Sanctions are designed to change your legal behavior with a view to promoting the objectives of the European Union and its foreign security policy. Like, it is the same, if you want to be very...
What shocks me about this is that European policy, foreign policy, is clearly doing huge damage to the European, to European states and the European people. If you look at the policy on Russia and Ukraine, even if the most pro-Ukrainian supporter would admit that European policy has been a disaster, it's caused huge damage to European industries. And so now you've got to this cycle, this damaging cycle, where you can't criticize European policy, even though European policy is wrong and it's damaging European interests.
I think it is a design cycle. I will do historical comparisons here. What is happening today, because you mentioned a couple of times that what is happening today, or what the European Union does today, is technically damaging the European economy, the European society, and you're right. And that happened also before Hitler took power back then. And Europe was, or Germany, was in an economical crisis. Its car industry, its industry, manufacturers, it was all in a crisis. And then Hitler came, took power, or they gave him the power. And he changed the whole industry into a militaristic industry. And this is what we're seeing today. We see, I mean, if you look at the statistics of the German government and the news about from the last 2 years, the car industry, which was the heart of Germany, is collapsing. It is compared to others around the world. And now they need to change that industry into something that is bringing you profits. And what brings you more profits than war? Because if you're on an active war, you need to buy weapons. Look at Germany's Rheinmetall. It was, their stock price were before the war in Ukraine on the bottom. Now it's skyrocketed. You can't even buy, I don't know if you are into stocks, but you can't even buy that now. They're billionaires, trillionaires today. And if you look who's benefiting from that crisis, I think things get very obvious. It's not the people in Europe. It's not the people in Russia, China, or whatsoever. It is these companies. It is these military-industrial complexes that benefit from it. That's why they want and need the war.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now brothers and sisters, we discovered something last time I was talking. This is just a preliminary. I want to finish it so we can move on to the other topics. What we discovered last time was this. Shaytan, Iblis, when it comes to us as believers, practicing believers, he doesn't have the same techniques or tools to use on us. Now, he's enemies with the whole world. He's enemies with us as well. But he can't get a practicing Muslim, a believer, a mu'min or a mu'mina, someone who takes Islam serious, to get out and start partying, to start drinking, right? That's not the test. However, Iblis can do something else. Example, Hezbollah, Israel, and the empire, right? Because it wasn't just Israel. The empire was fighting against Hezbollah. The empire. And they got their teeth kicked in. They saw they couldn't handle Hezbollah. They also have not been able to defeat and uproot Hamas. So what did they do? They went to Syria. They switched techniques. We'll strangle the resistance in a different way. Iblis, if he sees you and I, and we aren't the people who will commit those kind of major sins, does that mean Iblis says, okay, well, I throw in the towel then? Or is there another technique for Iblis? Or it's possible that he could be playing chess and we're playing checkers? Is it possible that Iblis could know another technique? And if this technique happens to the Muslims, I can get them to do a lot of mistakes. For instance, what could Iblis possibly do? We talked about this last time. It could possibly be the case that a practicing Muslim, you and I, a practicing Muslim can forget Allah. The practicing Muslim can possibly forget Allah. What can Iblis do? Iblis could do a very sinister technique. What could Iblis do? Iblis could make me, as a practicing Muslim, find the dunya to be very important. The dunya, in my eyes, is very kabir. I don't fall for the regular, I don't commit sins, I don't lie, I wear the hijab, I pay khums. What about the dunya? Is the dunya, in my eyes, is it a big thing? And we talked the other time about, let's not limit the dunya is just money. And no. There's a lot of, we looked at the hadith of Imam Sadiq, there were a lot of ways that a practicing Muslim who makes salat and prays and fasts and zakat and khums, that Muslim actually considers the dunya to be very big. What's the big deal about considering the dunya big? Iblis knows a trick. It's impossible for someone to consider the dunya to be grand, important, to be broken up by the dunya, and also consider Allah to be kabir. The victory of victories for Iblis. What did I do? I couldn't suggest that this mu'min or mu'mina, that they go over and commit these major sins. I did something much more deadly, a much more horrifying spiritual disease. I got the mu'min or mu'mina to believe the dunya is big. because I know what happens next. It doesn't work that way. It's impossible to think that the dunya is big and also think Allah is great. So, the disease that we're dealing with, the reason the believers aren't ready for the Mahdi, and I'm addressing myself, the reason that we're not ready yet, we're not out of the woods yet, is that there is a disease that infected a lot of the Muslims. This is why we all need to buy in. This isn't something you can do. Tell the staff. No, no. What do? We Muslims, unfortunately, we consider Allah small and unimportant. That's the disease. The results are very clear. But that's not the case. I consider Allah to be very great. Allah's my everything. Oh, okay. Well, if Allah's my everything, if I really consider Allah to be Kabir and Azim, those 10 things that I mentioned were traits. In all honesty, right now, do I have any anxiety or I have no anxiety at all? We talked about 10 different traits. As a believer, as a practicing person, right now, I have all of those things that were mentioned. Alhamdulillah, I walk and go home. Or no, those things are real. Those are not the description of who I am if I'm honest with myself. There is room for growth. Let me tell you a story that's not true, inshallah. They said once, this guy, he saw a little boy and he was sitting on a porch. It's not true. He was sitting on the porch and there was a really big, vicious-looking dog next to him. So the man asked him, he said,